Hello, everybody. I am Dave Levitan. I'm a freelance journalist. I focus often on the intersection of science and politics. Thank you for coming to our panel on Rethinking Climate Change Denial. I think we have a very cool set of speakers who I will introduce in a second. And what we're going to do is each of them will just talk for a little bit, and then I will throw some questions to them. And then we will open up for discussion with you guys with plenty of time left. The idea here, just quickly, was to explore sort of how climate change denial has shifted and continues to shift over time, how different types of rhetoric sometimes fall outside of what we might traditionally think of as denial, strictly speaking, and how we as journalists should be sort of thinking about that issue in order to cover climate-related stories as best we can. It's a pretty broad topic, obviously, so I thought it would be good to have perspectives here from media, the nonprofit advocacy world, and from academia. So first, next to me is Rebecca Lieber. She's a Mother Jones reporter in the magazine's Washington, D.C. bureau covering environment, climate change, and a bunch of other stuff. She has also been very doggedly covering Scott Pruitt's EPA recently, so I encourage everybody to check those stories out. Next to her is David Mazur. He is the executive director of Penn Environment, an organization that works to protect the environment from a range of threats in this state. And he also worked a couple years ago, I guess, on the transition with the new mayor of Philadelphia, which I thought was relevant, helping to bring sort of sustainability-related policy recommendations to the new mayor's desk. And finally, at the end, is Andrew Dessler. Andy is a professor of atmospheric sciences and the Earl F. Cook Professor of Geosciences at Texas A&M University, so he wins the prize for traveled farthest for this. And he works on a number of climate-related scientific topics. And he also worked a while back in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And from that experience, I think, is that right? You wrote a book sort of based on that time? That is called The Science and Politics of Global Climate Change, A Guide to the Debate. So again, relevant experience. Okay, so that's them, and I've talked enough. So why don't you each just go through a few minutes with your thoughts on sort of climate change denial in general. So Rebecca?
Hi. I'm Rebecca Lieber. I have been covering all sorts of things in the Trump administration for Mother Jones, and before that have worked at various publications on the same, on similar beats before Trump. So I would say since the start of the year, a big focus of mine has been the deregulatory beat, and because that is what is happening at the EPA and throughout the administration specifically, and just heard that I have been very focused on what the EPA administrator has been doing at the agency and what is different about his approach. And I think when we're talking about climate change denial, Scott Pruitt is a really interesting lens because we're seeing various tactics and a few things that are a bit different that help us kind of understand various approaches that see climate deniers take and that I've faced in reporting for the past few years. So just to go through briefly, because I think we're going to get into this much more, what is different about the Trump administration? I think we're seeing in the past where climate denial was a form of avoidance and of the issues and delaying, obviously to delay action, but basically to avoid the question on the science, we're seeing a more aggressive form of denial where it at times Pruitt and Trump have used it as, on the offense to attack scientists, to attack activists who work on this issue, and journalists. And I think we also are seeing an institutionalization of denial that has come out in policy. So it's not just a political talking point right now, but we're seeing it come out through potential challenges on the EPA's endangerment finding, which is the basis for its climate regulations, the proposal for a red team, blue team, to be on climate science. And at the same time, I think there are some themes that anyone who reports on this issue would you'd be well familiar with, that there is a fluidity of excuses used. And when you kind of pull them all together, they don't usually make much sense. That the ones that Pruitt specifically has used since his confirmation range from everything that now is not the time to talk about climate change because it's insensitive, to we've made so much progress in the U.S. on climate, why are we talking about it, to the U.S. will make no difference in climate change. So none of these don't actually make sense when you look at them as a package, but he's kind of cycled through these reasons since taking over the EPA, and I think that's something that reflects on the larger coalition or loose coalition of climate change deniers and their reasons to avoid the discussion.
Thanks. Again, my name is David Mazur, and I'm the executive director for a nonprofit group here in Pennsylvania called Penn Environment. I'm based in Philadelphia, but we're probably the largest citizen-based environmental advocacy group. So we work to combine citizen education and engagement with policy advocacy in Harrisburg and at the federal level. And so we spend a lot of time sort of in this world of messaging frames, how to move the public as a main audience for us. I was telling Andy, we run a big canvas operation. We knock on probably about 250,000 to 500,000 doors in Pennsylvania every year. So you can imagine if you go out to 100 or 1,000 random doors to talk to people at their homes about the environment of different backgrounds, you get a pretty interesting flavor of how the public here in Pennsylvania views the environment as a whole, climate change and other issues and politics in general. We're serving the belly of the beast. I think folks may know Pennsylvania has the third largest carbon footprint of any state in the nation, King Coal here in the Commonwealth. I think a couple of the main principles getting ready, and when I talked with Dave about today's event, that are on our mind as a nonprofit group and a group doing the citizen engagement are, to sort of back up what Rebecca said, I think we're at such an important crossroads in general on this issue, given the sort of rebirth of anti-science and anti-media has created a real recipe for disaster, I think, when moving ahead on tackling the issue of climate change. And so how are we going to address that double-edged sword that I think takes a big step back from the headway we've made over the years? Number two is sort of our strategy, which I think is a strategy used by a lot of the citizen groups trying to move the public, which I think, number one, we think a lot about audience and audience matters. So if it's dealing with elected officials, you know, we come at it a little differently than the general public. And even within the general public, we're not trying to move everyone. You know, I think we sort of look at the world and believe there'll always be some set of climate deniers, and we don't necessarily have to move them to move better policy to save the planet. We think most of the public's with us, and so we need to galvanize that and really keep them engaged. And I think that's hugely important right now. There's obviously a ton of activism in general around social issues post last November's election. But I think one of the things we're always trying to look at and engage is how do you keep the public and this high level of engagement and scrutiny up for what may be 3.5 more years or potentially longer. And that's, I think, a real challenge from an organizing perspective of not just the messaging, but on an issue that we know the public, you know, the polling shows the public's obviously fairly, climate change is not a very upbeat issue, so we all know that. How do you keep people focused and wanting to be civically engaged given the political climate, that it's more marathon than sprint? And so that's, I think, on our mind a lot. And then I think the third piece around just the role of the media, I mean, I think the challenges we face as the nonprofit advocates are a few. Number one, in our current era of tribalism, you know, I think we look at a big part of the root cause of the problem that we still live in a world where, number one, elected officials or other opinion leaders who can feed this narrative are given the space to do so and continue to validate this message for their listeners. So I think, if it's, Senator Marco Rubio saying, oh, sure, the climate's always changing, and of course there's been climate change, but we don't really know how much the public, how much we're responsible for. I think one challenge is how do we have objectivity in the media, but in this age of tribalism, make sure that the leaders of the anti, the climate denier movement aren't using that pedestal to embolden and continue to build a movement. I think if you can, cut that head off, you can pick up more of the general public. And if you can't move conservative elected officials, business leaders, or religious leaders as being the talking point, it'll be hard to move more of the public and the deniers. So I think that's a really important part that we see. And then my last part before maybe I hand it to Andy is obviously none of this has happened in a vacuum. I think sometimes we try and talk about this the way we talk about the flat earth stuff or 9/11 conspiracy theories. And I think it's important to remember the largest global warming polluters and their allies have spent years and tens of millions of dollars feeding a narrative that has gotten us to where we are today in the climate denial fight. That's very different. There's not really someone out there. There's not a special interest on 9/11 conspiracy theories feeding that. And when you have the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil with their PR, wing and their campaign contributions and their fake research, we can't forget that because we're in the place we are for, I think, a very particular reason. And I tend to think if that wasn't part of politics today, we would be in a very different place. So I think those are some things we think of from the nonprofit community side. So.
Great. So thanks. Let me begin by saying thanks to all the reporters in the room. As a scientist, I rely on you guys to get the word out. I can't do it myself. So thank you for your hard work. I can't imagine how depressing it must be for some of you. Dave wants to talk about denial in this, and so I'm going to give you basically a taxonomy of denial here. Now, let me begin by saying this. I've been doing this for a very long time. I think I'm much older than perhaps my boyish demeanor looks. I've been doing this since the 80s, and when I started, I was working on stratospheric ozone. And, so none of the arguments on climate change are new. They're the same arguments that were being advanced by, in some cases, the same people when it comes to stratospheric ozone. And so, and if you read Merchants of Doubt by Oreskes and Conway, which I'm sure many of you have read, it goes back 30 years before that. So this is not something that's new. Denial did not show up with climate change. Now, but what has happened is it's become a lot more sort of shameless. And what used to be subtext is now text. And that's true in a lot of respects in the current administration. But it's certainly true when it comes to climate denial. So I'm going to divide sort of denialist or skeptical arguments into basically three different categories. What I call process arguments, science arguments, and delay arguments. And I'll just talk briefly about each of these categories. So process arguments don't actually talk about science, but they talk about the process of science. So, for example, for those of you that really follow this, there was an article by Tom Carle in 2015. It came out in Science, and it was basically about the temperature, the warming of the last 20 years. Now, if you follow this, you know something called the hiatus, the fact there hasn't been a lot of warming, and Carle came up with this argument that, no, it actually has been warming. After that article came out, either a disgruntled coworker or a whistleblower, depending on your perspective, I presume, basically came out and said that there were some issues with how the paper was produced. He didn't say it was wrong, but he said they didn't follow the right procedure in getting the data approved and in archiving the data and things like that. So it was really this process argument. And so then Lamar Smith takes that. He's the head of the Science and Technology Subcommittee. Is that right?
Yeah. It's Committee on Science.
Yeah, it's Committee on Science and Technology. Takes that, and like a game of telephone, he kind of morphs it. It sort of turns into this idea that scientists are manipulating the data. And, And so use this sort of as this general attack on science itself. And other kinds of attacks that fall into this process category would be things like attacks on peer review, attacks on how grant funding is made. These are not arguments about facts. Is the climate warming or humans to blame? But there are arguments about how science works as a general approach of discrediting science. And these arguments are very litigious. You know, they're made by lawyers. They sound like they're made by lawyers. You know, it's like, you said here, you sent this email on September 3rd, but you didn't send until September 5th. Isn't that right? I mean, who cares? But, you know, their idea is to essentially make these people look buffoonish or corrupt. And, you know, it's very effective with scientists because, as a general rule, scientists don't care about those things. We care about what's right. We care about, you know, what is the Earth warming. We don't really care about the process. And so scientists can be admittedly a little bit sloppy when it comes to doing these things because, you know, no one wants to fill out forms. Nobody wants to do – you know, we don't go into science to do that. We go into science to find out sort of the truth about science. And I can give you lots of examples of this. So you can, I won't go into any other examples, but ask me questions about it. There are lots of examples. I would say the most sort of shameless process type argument is Scott Pruitt's Red Team, Blue Team, where he's essentially trying to redefine how science reaches conclusions. So for the last few hundred years, science has worked out this really very effective way to determine what is correct. And it's peer review followed by replication of important claims. So, you know, I'm an individual scientist. I go into the lab or on my computer. I have a hypothesis. I write the paper. I write it up. I submit it to a journal. It sends out for peer review. It passes peer review. That doesn't mean it's right. That just means it's gone through one step. Important claims then get retested in what I call the crucible of science. So ideas, the Earth is warming, humans are to blame, those ideas have been tested lots of times. People are still testing Einstein's theory of relativity. About once a year, I'll read about some group at CERN or some satellite that shows, yes, we've revalidated general relativity. I mean, people are always retesting important ideas. And so after a while, these ideas, you kind of say, yeah, this idea has been tested so many times, it's right. And Pruitt is essentially trying to do a really, in my view, transparent end run around science and redefine how science works. And he does that by trying to cast doubt on the present process and then say, we're going to do this red team, blue team, which he's only doing because the actual methods of science don't give him the results he wants. Moving on, the next type of argument are actual science arguments. And these turn, you know, the Earth is not warming, humans aren't to blame. These turn out to be relatively rare. Most politicians are not going to get up and say, the Earth is not warming. Now, Ted Cruz, an exception, of course, my senator, he will say there's been no warming in the last 20 years. It's pretty carefully caveated, though, the way he says it. Scott Pruitt will say that he doesn't think that carbon dioxide is a primary control on the climate. So there are a few, but the reasons politicians don't like to get into those arguments is that it's pretty clear they don't know what they're talking about. And so usually what they do is they don't flatly contradict the science, but they'll make an argument. We just don't know. We just don't know if the Earth is warming. We just don't know if humans are to blame. There's lots of uncertainty. And so I think, you know, Scott Pruitt, I have a quote here. He says, I think that measuring with precision human activity and climate is something very challenging. Yes, okay, I will agree with that. And there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. You know, again, there are a lot of sort of adjectives in there that aren't, you know, tremendous. There's some disagreement. And then he goes on to say, therefore, I don't believe CO2's the primary control mob. And that doesn't really follow from the conclusion doesn't fall from the predicate of that. And so these things are really, and his first two statements, though, are right. You know, it is hard to measure it. There are lots of really smart people doing it, though. And so we have a pretty good idea of how much the Earth has warmed. And there's been an entire industry that's looked at detection attribution of the warming. And we can say with high confidence, we can't say exactly how much we're warming, but we can say we're now the dominant driver of the climate system on multi-decadal timescales. And I'll just say, frequently these two types of arguments, you can't cleanly separate them. They're kind of mixed together. You have a process argument mixed with a science argument to make it really hard to figure out To make it as confusing as possible for people listening. And so, the people out there who don't want to believe in climate change, it gives them sort of ammunition. Like, yeah, well, of course you can't trust the scientists, and measuring the warming is really hard, and there are things we don't understand about the climate system. Ergo, we don't know anything, and which is not correct. And then finally, I'll say there's the people I call delayers. So an example, someone like Bjorn Lomborg, if you know him. So he's somebody who says, climate change is real. I believe in climate science, but it's still not something we should worry about. It's important to realize that despite the fact that he claims, he always starts his claim with, I believe science, he really doesn't believe the science, or he believes part of the science, because he'll always say, well, if we take the average of the IPCC's projected warming, it's, 2.6 degrees over the 21st century, but, you can't look at the average. That's one way of looking at it. You could say, well, let's look at the worst case scenario, or let's, but he doesn't accept that. And so all of these arguments by people who are sort of the reasonable middle actually are still based on denial of science, even though they're trying to portray themselves as, well, of course I believe the science. But even if you do, it leads you to this crazy conclusion over here, because they're not actually accepting the richness of the science. The science tells you a lot more than just the average prediction for the 21st century. I have a lot more, but I'll stop there. And I'm happy to answer. If people want more examples of those like that, you can ask questions.
Great. Well, thank you all for those intros. That was great. So I think the first question I want to throw to you guys is one that, Rebecca, you actually mentioned when we were emailing about this, that sometimes people who want to either delay, as Andy was talking about, or just completely deny the science entirely, tend to turn it around and portray those who are pushing for action on climate change as somehow fanatics, right? As painting climate change as if it's a religion, as if science is somehow based around belief and not around actual evidence. This often comes from sort of relatively centrist politicians, not even people that far on the extremes. It's not so much a specific denial point about the science, but it serves to frame anyone who actually listens to science as some sort of fringe element. And I'm wondering if you guys have thoughts just on sort of how to deal with that. I mean, when it gets turned around on people who are trying to pay more attention to the science, what do we do with that?
So I wrote something on this a few years ago for the New Republic on what it means when we talk about believing in science. And this is a personal pet peeve of mine, actually, when covering climate change and seeing how other outlets, writers cover this issue, is the persistence of the word belief. And in questions to politicians, what you usually hear on, it's usually from political press, not necessarily people who cover environment and climate or science. It's, do you believe in climate change? And that question is very problematic for a lot of reasons. One, you kind of are buying into the framing already that climate deniers have set up of that this is about faith, and this is about whether you believe in, essentially it's a religious, one example is like Lindsey Graham, who is seen as more moderate on this issue than where most of the Republican Party is today in Congress. He has likened scientists and climate advocates to religious fanatics. And I think asking, do you believe in climate change, lets already the speaker, whoever you're asking, avoid really answering that question. My second pet peeve with that question is one of the most common answers when you ask, do you believe in climate change, is a politician saying, of course I believe in climate change. I'm just not sure how much of a role humans play. And that is really the most common dodge that we see. It's just, you're setting up a T-ball question if you're asking that. I think the easiest thing to do is start it with, do you accept the consensus that humans are the primary driver of climate change is just you're already elevating that conversation. There's definitely other ways to ask that and follow up. But I think both in asking tighter, smarter questions and in how we're writing about this issue and not adopting words like belief and faith, that reporters can really elevate the coverage of this issue.
Sure. I mean, I totally agree. I think we try and jujitsu this. You know, again, we come at it a little differently. You know, again, I think the audience matters and the place where the conversation matters. So I think a lot of elected officials don't want to go on record on saying they're climate deniers, so they come up with this mealy-mouthed language. I can't tell you how many times over the years and still today when I go to the state capitol, legislators just will flat out in a meeting say, oh, no, that there's no proof or the science isn't real. And there's a comfort zone. They're willing to say that in a place where there's just me or a couple of nonprofit groups. They probably don't want to be in the Philly Inquirer, the Post-Gazette, sort of saying something that is so out of touch with where much of the public is and even their own constituents. So, but to Rebecca's point, I think, you know, we try and corner them on this language as much as possible. And we actually had a vote in the state legislature 2 years ago, which I think speaks to this. The majority party was moving a bill that would have made it harder for Pennsylvania to implement the Clean Power Plan. And Democrats were sort of trying to figure out how do they slow it down and stop it. The clock was running out on the session. And so Democratic State House member from Bucks County offered an amendment where he just added a whereas clause, which said, whereas climate change is real, the effects are disastrous, and it's predominantly caused by human activity, dot, dot, dot. They could not get the vote. Once that they had to call a vote on the amendment before they could call the final vote, they couldn't call the vote because the Republicans caucused and they couldn't take that public position. So I think that sort of speaks to this issue of depending where they are and who they're speaking to, you know, they're more or less brazen. And I think it gets to this point of if you can really nail them in, they know they're out of touch with the science and even the public opinion and even their constituents in red districts. So they don't want to have to make a decision, honestly, in that way. So I think we deal with this a lot on the politics side. But if you can get a lot of members one-on-one, I can't tell you how many legislators said, oh, there's a letter signed by 11,000 scientists. I mean, you know, Dave's laughing because that's like, oh, that's such like 2012 thing to say. But it still comes up today. And they can say that because they're in a room with two other people, not under the scrutiny of the media. So,
yeah, I think to me it shows how effective climate skepticism is, that this is a completely manufactured problem. When people say, well, I believe in that, they don't I mean, you know, if I say I believe in climate change, it doesn't mean that I believe it in some religious standpoint. I mean, I'm a physicist. I've looked at the data. I mean, it's all I do. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years. And, you know, I'm convinced by the evidence. But, you know, shorthand is you say you believe it. But they've turned this shorthand that a lot of people use into this really, you know, I think we could argue about how effective it is. But it's another, you know, you throw enough shit against the wall, some of it's going to stick. And that's what they're just sort of doing. It's another piece of shit they're throwing against the wall. And, you know, so it's in some sense it's sloppy. It's everybody knows what they really mean. It's sloppy language, but they've turned it into an issue. And I think, you know, I think what Rebecca said is right. You know, phrase your question accurately. I mean, you know, I'd love to see somebody answer the question, do you believe in the scientific consensus that humans are now the dominant driver of the climate system? And, you know, have them tackle that. And they'll have to say no. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we've already talked a little bit about how what some of the versions of this we've seen in the new administration, and I'm curious what you guys think is sort of the most insidious version of climate change denial. If it's just saying it's a hoax, if that is the most, I mean, Andy, you said you're not so sure if the belief thing is effective, if that's actually doing as much damage as some other forms. I'm curious what you think are the most effective versions. Personally, I find the repeated talking point about economics related to climate change to be the hardest to break through. It seems to be almost dogma that it's too expensive to do anything about this. So that almost gives them a leg up because they're admitting it's a problem. They're just pretending that there's no solution, which there's plenty of evidence against. So I'm just curious if you guys have thoughts on what are the worst of these? What versions are the most effective?
Yeah, I can start off with that. So if you take the tobacco playbook, it's essentially there's not a single argument, but there's a series of arguments they make that I think are very effective. So you know, it's fear, uncertainty, and death. You know, those things. So the first thing you say we're not sure about it. Plus, it's going to bankrupt middle class families. So it's always, if we do policies, it's always going to cost $1,000, $2,000, because nobody would believe a policy would cost $20,000 a year. And if it only costs $100 a year, that's probably not enough. So they always come up with these estimates. It is going to cost the average family $1,000 or $2,000, which is enough to really hurt the finances of a lot of families. So, and the thing that's important to realize about that is they've made that argument before every environmental policy. So before acid rain, they made that argument. Before ozone phased out fluorocarbons for ozone depletion, there are all these things about how you have to give up your air conditioners. And now they're saying it about climate change. And the thing that's amazing is no matter how many times that argument gets proved to be wrong, these environmental policies always are much cheaper to implement than people thought they were, because people are so clever. That argument never gets discredited, because fear works. In fact, I think Ed Maybach said it: fear works, or somebody said it. I can't remember who said it in that previous. Fear works, and so you can scare the crap out of people. You will get them to argue. You'll get them to oppose policies. There's just really no evidence that it actually would be that expensive. And especially if you look at all the previous history of these environmental policies, they always come out to be cheaper because I think Paul Krugman makes a really good argument about, the conservative argument is always that the free market will solve everything. It's incredibly efficient. People are really smart. But the one thing it cannot seem to do is if you put a carbon tax, it can't seem to handle that effectively. It'll just bankrupt everybody. It's like, you know, the cleverness of the market goes out once you put a tax on carbon. And it's completely inconsistent thinking. And, you know, the history tells us that the market can handle these price signals very well. And people will innovate, and they'll come up with very clever solutions.
Oh, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to jump in and say, because I'm not sure I'm on the same page with Dave on that the economics is the toughest part of this, of covering climate denier excuses, because I think when you're getting into policy, and I love covering policy, so this might just be because this is a big area of mine, but I think you are at least, I don't know, it's not, I hate to rank forms of climate denial, but you're getting past the there is no scientific consensus on this, and you're getting into, like, how do we act? And that is a different kind of debate. It's certainly challenging, but I think another just kind of form of this that we see that I've found challenging, and I'm curious to hear how others respond to this, is when there's, you'll have a hearing. We actually had this earlier this year. I believe it was the House Science Chair, Lamar Smith, had a committee hearing on climate science, essentially, where he was trying to prop up the uncertainty about this. And they invited it was three scientists who don't agree with the consensus and Michael Mann, and to represent the consensus. And they were basically trying to prop up scientists to elevate their own talking points, and they're using this in a very political way. But I think in that one case that I was covering this hearing, It actually turned into this inside fight among scientists that the entire hearing kind of I covered this at Mother Jones. It kind of derailed a bit from looking at what the science says on climate change to this essentially political talking points, which happens a lot in congressional hearings, so this is not unusual. But that one I found, I can find that a bit challenging in reporting on, because you're getting into how much is this about a personality versus the data here.
Yeah, and maybe I'll start there and work backward. I mean, I think this is what we would call the dueling scientists, maybe, is like sort of 101 of our opposition. Like they sort of feel like if, you know, we've seen it again, like Andy said, I think every issue, tobacco and everything else, that if you can get anyone with the letters PhD at the end of their name to stand up and say smoking's good for you or the earth is flat or whatever your thing is, then the science clearly is still out because there's someone somewhere who's contrarian. You know, we're trying to, of course, from the advocacy community, just debunk that strategy everywhere we can, and of course it helps if the media is trying to, you know, stick to the overwhelming reality on things like climate change, that there is consensus. So I think that's a very common thing we see on almost every issue, like our opponents on, you know, fracking is good for you, coal is good for you, like you can put it on your cereal, it'll deal with premature hair loss, everything's great. They'll find someone to say that, so we just have to sort of push up against that. Dave, to your original question, I think the most insidious piece right now is just the institutionalized from the top down, as I said earlier, anti-science in total and anti-media in total really will crumble at just the core of how democracy works if we can't deal with that in a larger societal way. It just peels off too many people and leaves too much question in the democratic process. So for me, that's sort of the biggest fear, is how do you deal with a White House that, you know, will criticize every media outlet, but if Rush Limbaugh gets up and says, extreme weather and getting the public riled up is to sell more bottled water, like that's somehow like real media. But if you're talking about extreme weather and climate, now it's fake. That's like, to me, the most sort of dangerous place we are right now. And then I do, I don't think this earlier point about jobs and the environment, like it may not play out in the media, but certainly for us on the ground, I think this is like the death knell. And again, to Andy's point, we've seen this argument made on everything. And I think we have to find a way to move beyond it. So every time something on climate change comes up in the Pennsylvania legislature, the industry's playbook is, you know, peel off groups that are sort of the traditional left. And the way that works is to isolate out the environmental community and the labor community quickly. And the way you do that is, you know, and you see it time and time again, you just get the United Mine Workers, who are very influential, even though they don't employ that many people in the Commonwealth anymore, to say, you're going to lose jobs if we do anything on climate change. And then the UMWA goes to the AFL, and the AFL comes out and says, we need to pass a law to stop Pennsylvania from implementing the Clean Power Plan. Or, you know, and then you lose half the Democrats as well as 90% of the Republicans, and you just get rolled time and time again. So, you know, I think the root cause of this is we have we built an economy that is all driven by resource use and buying stuff and being consumers, and that means we built jobs around it. And until we can move to a different post-scarcity worldview, I think this jobs and the environment thing is just, you know, again, from the environmental community, not the media, it's just going to be a dog for us. We can never really win, and there's so much anxiety with the average household in the economy today. It's a great messaging point for our opponents.
And
I
realized because I didn't quite answer your question on insidious forms of climate denial, and David made a really important point. I think the difference we're seeing is we have shifted Overton window, essentially, where the president is saying this is an outright hoax, and many of the people he's appointed say the same thing. So other forms, if a politician is saying, they're using a kind of one of the grayer areas here of getting into the policy debate, saying, well, this will cost a lot, or, well, maybe it won't be so bad, so we shouldn't act. We should wait another 2 decades, 3 decades, and hope that everyone's wrong is another form we haven't talked about. But I think it's just giving permission that and almost it's shifting the perspective that, well, that these are all different shades of climate denial and skepticism, and it suddenly makes that it almost gives it more permission. And that's what I've seen as a worrisome trend.
I was going to also say something about what Dave said about general attacks on science. I think you can look at the attacks on climate science embedded in a general view where, you know, some fraction of the population just sort of suspects academics and science in general. So a few days ago, the Supreme Court had a gerrymandering case, and John Roberts said something about this gobbledygook about these mathematicians who are trying to draw, essentially come up with metrics for how gerrymandered the case was. And so, you know, here's the Supreme Court saying, you know, these eggheads, why listen to them? You know, it's hard to understand, so, you know, it's giving itself permission to sort of avoid looking at science. And you see this in the climate debate as sort of a microcosm, but it's happening all over our society.
Sure.
I know it is. I guess my last plug on the post-scarcity issue that I mentioned is I think now the automation issue in jobs changes the larger public conversation about like jobs in the environment was sort of a siloed problem, which we always lost, essentially, I think. I think now that we see automation, and you know, for those of us who follow it, automation was a big root cause of that, right? Like, you know, President Trump says the war on coal and he'll bring coal jobs back, but everybody in Pennsylvania knows, you know, we don't mine for coal with people anymore. And Governor Wolf just did a ribbon cutting, sadly, at a new coal mine and touted the 67 whopping jobs we're going to create because there are no jobs. And now that automation is infiltrating into other parts of our economy, I think it opens the door to have this larger conversation about what is the future of work, what is the society, and what is the value of work, and what drives our economy overall. So I think we'll see more of that with a driverless car, which could blow the whole roof on this. So,
I want to get to Q&A very quickly, but so I'm going to ask for really quick answers on this one from you guys. I'm just curious. I mean, so Rebecca, you were talking about how you know, the institutionalization, I guess, of denial in a really sort of, you know, shifted way that the president has said that, you know, the whole thing is a hoax. So I'm wondering if, you know, if we as reporters, I guess, should be focusing on debunking every last claim like that. Like every time someone says something absurd, should we all write stories about why it's absurd? Or is that just like sort of playing into their hands in a way? Should we be focusing on the policy questions, on the, you know, what form should a carbon tax take or something like that? Again, so if you guys have quick thoughts so we can get to Q&A.
I think everyone's dealing with this right now. There's so much happening that it's impossible to. There's just only so many hours in the day of debunking every single thing that's out there. There's a lot. Just yesterday, it was hard to keep track of with EPA hearings for nominees we saw new one of the appointees. Trying to just say, well, I've never seen that data set, so I can't comment. So I think I try to pay attention to trends and realize these are not isolated events when Trump is saying something and he's quoting a report. That report, usually they would have looked at, maybe if they're talking about costs of acting on climate change, they're just looking at the costs and not the benefits, and trying to connect the dots and find those trends. I also pay attention to, I do look at how Breitbart is covering this issue. I talk to people at Heartland and other, and I think it's because it's important to understand what they're saying in terms of covering this. I approach this a bit differently than other reporters in the room, I'm sure, but I think it's important to understand also what the other side, what they're essentially saying, and in order to help debunk and make help readers understand.
I think this is a real catch-22. I think the press is damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like I said at the beginning, I think the real challenges in the era of this tribalism we're in and the polarization, the audience will look at, you know, the media, the fake news, depending who the audience is, right? And when you have Scott Pruitt talking about whatever the crazy thing of the day will be, right? The reader, if they're not firmly with us, they're just going to, in this tribalistic sense, they're going to choose who they are usually with. And it probably won't be the, you know, mainstream news source. It may not be the academics and the science community. So they just go, I'm with Trump or I'm with whomever. And that then becomes, instead of a debunking, it becomes a validator because they look to leaders. I mean, I think I was talking to one of the folks here last night. You know, I think if you had if Obama and a Republican introduced the same policy, you'll get very different blowback from different parts of the public because of this tribalism. It's not the policy; it's the person who's at the head of the thing, and so I think it's you're sort of, like I said, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You don't cover it, you're feeding their ability to be out there stoking it, and if you cover it, certain parts of the general public read and say, well, you're the bad guy, so the person you're quoting as the kook is actually, like, mm-hmm. I'm more firmly in their camp in this tribalistic world we live in.
Yeah.
I don't know what reporters should do. I will say that the social science research suggests that trying to debunk stuff doesn't work, backfire effect, that if you debunk it, it just actually reinforces the idea. If you ask people a few days later, they'll believe the myth. So when I talk to people, if someone asks me a question, you know, I don't go into a long argument about why it's wrong. I sort of say, well, that's not right. We know we're loading the atmosphere with carbon. We know the Earth is warming. We know humans are now the dominant. You know, just sort of repeat your talking points. And I don't know. I guess reporters may not have talking points, so I don't know if that's what will work for you. But that's what I do. I mean, I don't try to debunk.
Okay. Sure.
Very briefly, something that a lot of reporters do cover this do is always throw that in a story on when you're talking about climate change. Throw in that the consensus says humans are driving climate change. So like, you can squeeze that into any story essentially.
Great. Okay, we would now love it if you guys have any questions. Just real quick, so as usual, SEJ members, active associate, and academic members go first. Everyone else can wait till after them. Everyone, please ID yourself when you ask your question. I will then repeat it because we're recording this and needs to be into a microphone. But go ahead. In the back of the house first. So just to repeat the question, he's asking, you know, why don't we or should we go back to some earlier research? The example was a 89 study by the EPA to sort of highlight how scientists have got some things right. And why don't we focus on that instead of just sort of, I guess, repeating some of the same things over and over. So anyone? Thoughts?
Sure. I think that's a great point on looking to just the decades of research and realizing nothing we're seeing is new, as Andrew pointed out earlier. I think that's just it's a great point to look to what the research that when we're talking about climate change today, this is not just one scientist saying it. This is built on years and thousands of papers and scientists who have worked on this issue. And I'm not familiar with that specific example from the EPA.
There was a huge study done in the 1980s under the Reagan and Bush administrations, and one of the very first things it talks about is the consensus on humans affecting climate change. It's EPA making this. It was a congressionally mandated study.
Yeah. Yeah, I think something that I try to talk about in writing, that it's not doesn't go back to 89, but when Pruitt is talking about that we should debate this issue, that we don't need to relitigate climate science. The EPA did this repeatedly, starting well before, it sounds like, the Bush administration, but the Bush administration actually kicked off the endangerment finding research, and that the EPA, looking at the global work on this issue, has said over and over again, this is where it stands. And I think citing that past research certainly does help readers understand that this is not a brand new issue.
Yeah, I think you made a good point. The gold standard of science is successful prediction. If you can predict something in advance that's not obvious, that really says you understand something fundamental about the physical system. And, you know, climate skeptics never make predictions. There's never a single skeptical prediction that's ever come true. And so I think it is very useful to point those things out. As a scientist, though, you know, I'm always looking forward. You know, I don't really care about the things we understand. I care about things we don't understand. So science has a problem of always talking about uncertainty, because that's the most interesting thing to us. And so I completely agree. I think, you know, better public messaging of the long history of climate science would be very helpful. You know, I mean, Fourier is the person who did the first, you know, really did the foundational work. You know, as far as I know, he wasn't a liberal activist. Although, who knows? Maybe he was a socialist.
Yeah.
You guys talked about, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist based in Oberlin, Ohio, SEJ member since 2003. You've talked a lot about what doesn't work. It doesn't work to get into the argument about belief. It doesn't work to just debunk because people don't believe it. What does work? Case in point, I live in the Great Lakes. I talk about the algae problem he's talking about. And what I'm trying to do is show people that climate changes here right now. I'm talking to farmers who don't believe it, don't use those terms. I ask them what they're seeing and what their problems are. And then I tell them what I just heard from the scientists down the road that they already know about, or that they... You know, they know about the university comes from. Oh, okay, he's okay. Is that the kind of approach that works? Are there other approaches that work?
So the question was, you know, we've heard a lot about what we're all doing wrong, what doesn't work, and so the question is sort of what does work. And there's an example about talking about algae blooms in the Great Lakes and sort of making it more focused on the individual, what they're seeing up close, and if maybe that's an approach that might work, or other ideas. So
I'm glad you asked that question. I mean, again, so from the citizen side, this is like our constant, you know, circle of hell we live in. I mean, the issue is so depressing, you just want to shut down. I think the good news is...
Strength.
hug me, Andy, yeah. Please. I need a hug right now. I mean, there is a lot of social science out there about what does resonate and work. So if folks are familiar with the Climate Advocacy Lab, which is an awesome place where they centralize polling data about public opinions around climate change, clean energy, and the environment. They break it down by geography, by political beliefs. They've done some really great stuff post-Trump's election on views of conservatives around climate change and what messages resonate and how they're talking and thinking about it. So I recommend that as a resource to just stay on top of this. I think what we've learned is you have to pivot pretty quickly from talking about the problem to talking about solutions because the problem is so big and profound. So at Penn Environment, you know, if you go to our website, we talk about our campaign on climate change as, global warming solutions to try and quickly move people into the frame of it's not too late, we can do something. I think there's sort of tied to that, depending who your audience is and what your end game is, talking about in a practical way, the solutions. And by that, I mean, we may have in Pennsylvania, if I talk to someone from the Farm Bureau or other ag folks, they may be skeptical on climate change, but they're very excited about clean energy because they control it. They can reduce its, in the marketplace of your farmer, you don't control many costs, but that you can control as an expense. So talking about the solutions, we stop fighting with the labor unions when we talk about putting solar on roofs because those are union jobs. So I think those are some of the things that we see as, places where we can move the public in a positive way and not get too mired down.
If I can just add something really quick. This is now a few people who've mentioned things that made me think of Dan Kahan's work. He's a professor at Yale, I think. And he's talked a lot about how he uses an example of the Kentucky farmer, which is a not real person. But that if you ask them, do you believe in climate change, they will say no, and they'll say it's a big conspiracy. But if you ask them about preparing for drought or dealing with things that affect their actual existence, they are 100%, in lockstep with what the science tells them. So I don't know what that necessarily tells us as reporters to do, but it's something to think about and it's someone to read if you're interested. But yeah. Sure.
Just I think one thing we haven't talked about are value systems, and that I think has also been proven as from the social science standpoint as a big driver in how people view climate change. So I think when you're talking about farmers and drought, one thing the climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe does extraordinarily well is she talks about the science. She does a whole presentation, but she always connects it to values. And she speaks as she is religious. She is in a conservative part of the country and is always communicates why we should be acting and that this is there are different forms of arguments, but sometimes it's about insurance and now we're seeing with these hurricanes there's a huge humanitarian angle to this. And as a reporter, I think the seeking out voices who can give that perspective and maybe as the reporter, you can't necessarily make the values argument, but people who communicate that well, or maybe there is the farmer turned climate advocate, as we saw on as we're seeing on some pipeline issues, who would be that person who gives you that quote that connects us for you?
Can I say one more thing real quick, Dave, just
sure,
for this? Because
yeah.
I think this is a hugely important point and gets back to this tribalism piece, which is the more the media, instead of quoting the person who's going to use a skeptic and challenge the science message, the more we are, I think, going back and quoting and referencing, the so-called leaders within the conservative community or the potential denier community, farmers, religious leaders, business leaders. I mean, I was, telling my friend Frank, if you're here in Pennsylvania and you go up to the Pocono Raceway, it's like a great example. It's a big NASCAR racetrack, 100% solar powered. That messenger, a quote from a business leader in NASCAR, must be like NASCAR is like the clean energy leader. That's what circle of hell have I now entered or something. But we have to start using these role models to be the sound bites and the quotes, not the deniers and giving them that space. Because mm-hmm. They care to, they want to hear more from NASCAR than they want to hear, honestly, from Penn Environment.
Right. Okay. Yeah, right here? Oh, okay. Sorry.
let me say really quickly. If you look at Merchants of Doubt and you ask about tobacco, how long did it take for us to convince people on tobacco? It took 40 years. And so if you apply kind of a similar time scale to climate, and you figure, okay, maybe we started in the late 80s, early 90s. That's like 2030 to convince people. Eventually, we're going to win. Eventually, science will be accepted. But the question is, how long is it going to take? And I used to think the price of renewables was dropping so fast that people would just start installing renewables without, you know, it wouldn't take any government policy. But now we're reaching a point where the Department of Energy is actually actively intervening to prop up coal plants. So, I mean, it's as Dan Kahan points out, your view on climate change is a shortcut to your tribal identity. And so, you know, people view it to be part of the gang. It's not based on anything rational anymore, like a rational belief that it's going to be expensive. So I don't know how to break that. I've often thought that there's a good book or a PhD thesis in how climate change became such a political issue. If anyone wants to write a book on that, talk to me. I think that is really incredibly important, and I have no idea how it is, but it takes some good investigative journalism, I think.
Yeah. So the question is, basically, what is the role of reporters to convince people that climate change is real, and how if it is our role, how to do that? And it's an interesting point that that covering climate is not necessarily the same thing as convincing people of its reality. So that's an interesting question. Anybody?
Yeah. First of all, I love the Chronicle, my hometown paper. You know, I think as a scientist, I'm happy if people cover it accurately. I don't think they need to do anything more than that. Just don't give space to terrible arguments and sort of say this is what the science tells us. I'm happy. I don't know if that's take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. There's like the meta how we talk about climate change story, and then there's the what's actually happening because of climate change story, and those are separate things. I think I generally am not approaching my work to, I'm not trying to convince the very tiny denier community to suddenly revisit all of this. I do think it's reporters' jobs to clear up to at least on some confusing points and arguments as it relates to utilities. You can think of some areas this crosses over of making sure the reporting isn't confusing and that we are conveying what scientists publish in an accurate way that the layman can understand. I do think that is the media's job here, but I guess on utilities, I can just how utilities are approaching climate change is its own. I'm sure it's a fascinating beat, and especially with what's going on the Clean Power Plan. But I think again in a lot of these companies, it's not up for debate. This is a fact, and they are responding to climate change. They are responding to the rise of renewables and the decline of coal. And that I think you're actually helping convince people by writing stories that isn't up for debate in industries that if you weren't familiar with this issue, you might think they would take. They would agree with the skeptics and deniers, but really there is wide diversity. So.
Yeah, can I add one thing? I'm not sure I think that the media has a responsibility to convince people. I do think the media has a responsibility to not validate this space of denying the science. And those are a little bit different to me. I tend to think... we give whatever that climate denier community is a lot more rope in the media than we would other conspiracy theorists. There'll not be a story on, you know, the racial strife in this country where you'll find someone with a PhD who would say, you know, the science is still sort of out on Latinos, genetics, something like that would be uncharted territory because really the science is so. You know, we just say that's factually false, and yet, or smoking. We never say, oh, well, here's a, we're going to quote some weirdo PhD guy on smoking still okay for you. And yet, we do allow that in our reporting. So to me, it's not about confirming, you know, or trying to move people. It's about not giving the bandwidth to create some debate on science, and that I think we have still plenty of. Within the media. And then the way to do that, like I said earlier, is I think that we have to get better messengers who these skeptics or potential skeptics in the public will listen to, if it's the evangelical community or the business community, that sort of thing. So that's sort of, I sort of turn it on its head a little bit, if that makes any sense. But
okay. Got 15 seconds.
Sure.
Yeah, just to emphasize the point Rebecca made, most skeptics are unconvincible. So you don't even think you can convince him. I have a brother-in-law. He's a Carnegie Mellon grad. He's an orthopedic surgeon at St. Luke's in Houston. He lives in Bel Air, and he is absolutely unconvincible. He's an incredibly smart guy, but he, you know, he thinks Obama's a drug dealer, and I mean, you know, you cannot convince him. He is absolutely unconvincible, but an incredibly smart guy. Don't even think about trying to convince those people. Just report the facts, and hopefully you'll sway the disengaged middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
I'm Emily Schring. I work for the public radio and Northwestern Network. I'm based in Spokane, Washington. And I found in my reporting that among lawmakers and legislators and also the public, there's a lot of discomfort surrounding the language of being human caused, more so than actually arguing whether climate change is a thing or not. And I wonder if you think it's important to convince people that this is human caused, or just sort of, when are we ready to move beyond whether or not we caused it and the fact that it's just a thing that's happening? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So hold on. Let me just repeat the question real quick. So the question was that there's discomfort with the term human caused, and that should we be moving beyond trying to debate and or convince on whether or not climate change is human caused and just talk about it as a thing that is happening? Is that reasonable? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just say from a logical standpoint, if climate change is not human caused, then there's no reason to reduce emissions. All you'd be doing is adapting. So I think it is an important part of the argument. So you can't advance the debate without establishing that.
Yeah, maybe to back up Andy. I mean, this is why politicians use that, I think, as they've looked at all the same information and realize, oh, we look like kooks if we say it's not real. But there's this mushy middle where if we say this other thing, right, and it's a cycle that feeds itself. So I'm not surprised that that's sort of what you would experience and that we'd see. And that's why politicians, I think, love to be in that space.
Rebecca, you got no? Okay. Yeah, come back.
This just might be a bit of a reiteration of Kyle Banky's post from Bucks County Courier Times outside Philly. So I cover this local community newspaper. It's about 50% Democrats, 50% Republicans. I do projects, so I do maybe 7 or 8 project pieces a year, so I really only spend maybe 1 or 2 on climate change. So I'm interested in maybe like a multiple choice question for you guys. What should I do with that project? My first idea was maybe focusing on meeting the argument. I did a story in the past where I think it's Dr. Alley at Penn State, who's like a Republican in climate science. I ran the story, and of course, all the same people were in the comment section on Facebook. Didn't feel like I'd move the needle. So, do I double down, maybe visit the Pocono Raceway, maybe talk to the Army Corps of Engineers locally, entities that people who aren't convinced at this point, maybe that'll do it for them? Or should I just move on? So that would be maybe like A.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you before you list all your possibilities just because we're down to 5 minutes. But it's a good question in general. So the question was, you know, for a smaller outlet who, you know, he doesn't have a ton of time to spend all his time on climate stories, where should he focus? Where should a reporter that doesn't get to cover this all the time focus their energies? And is it on sort of debunking? Is it on convincing people? Where do we go first? So.
I mean, I think going back to the point of it's not quite about convincing the unconvincible people, but about there are a lot of people who are just not as informed on this. I would lean towards doing some kind of impact reporting of what how climate change is impacting a local community than trying to focus on again on this meta debate, because I don't think that reaches the audience that you might be trying to reach.
I guess my answer goes, Kyle, to your question, and then the woman from Spokane. I think an important, in general, piece that the media has to focus on is more regularly affirming the consensus on the science, period. Because the data we have is that as the numbers, as the public grows in support that climate change is real and it's a disaster and all those pieces, the numbers on when you poll the public on consensus in the scientific community is incredibly low. And so this sort of gets back to that thing of, you know, it's a human cause and part of Kyle's question. We need to move that. I think it's like the last poll I saw is 13% of the public believes there's consensus in the scientific community. And so we have to do a better job of trying to fix that, you know, that space where the public is, by just affirming over and over, no, the science on this is, you know, as strong as the science on tobacco and a round planet and everything else, to get those numbers up on consensus.
I don't feel sort of qualified to tell you what to report on, but I would say that sort of my sense is that hopeful articles are probably what we need now rather than relitigating science. So examples where people switched renewables and it saved them money, it didn't put them out of business. I think the Kentucky Coal Museum went solar. There are lots of examples of to fight back on the myth that'll be expensive. I think if people realize that we could switch renewables and it wasn't going to bankrupt us, I think there'd be really widespread agreement that we should do it. Now, it doesn't still mean we do it. If you look at gun control, you know, there are wide swaths of America that support policies that still can't get through Congress. But I would try to say be hopeful. You know, that's what I, as a sort of a consumer of news and as a scientist, that's what I like to see. You know, articles that say we can do this, because I think that doesn't get reported as much as perhaps it should.
If you can do it in like 20 seconds. So the question was, are we ignoring the fact that some minority communities might not be aware of the human-caused nature of climate change? That is a very interesting and wide-ranging question. Does anybody have quick thoughts on it?
I do. I think most of the polling shows us the opposite. Most of the polling actually shows the minority community has the highest numbers of knowledge about climate change, concern, and wanting to tackle it above almost any demographic community. So I guess yes. I don't think we need to broach that. I think that.
I am a minority. I'm Mexican, and yeah. I cover Hispanics. And to be honest, yeah, they might know, they might be aware and want to help, but I do really see that there's no engagement. So how do you bring them to the conversation?
Well, we could talk about that.
Real quick. I'll just go back to what I was saying earlier. I think it goes back to it's not just about talking about science, it's talking about impacts, and that's where minority communities are. That's who is experiencing the worst impacts of climate change. We are seeing this in real time, and telling that story and telling it while connecting it to the climate science is incredibly important. We are not seeing that in large part, I think, in the coverage of these hurricanes, and I hope we see that more going forward, and connecting it to both the horrible impacts, but how this is just going to continue and grow worse.
All right. Well, so since I've been threatened with my life if I do not end this on time, it is now 12:15, and lunch will be starting immediately after this in the ballroom, so everyone should head right into there. Thank you very much to the panelists. Thank you all for coming, and we're all happy to answer other questions if there's more to talk about.